Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, August 15th, 2002. Today's session is titled, Life Stories, Paths Untrodden, Perils Unknown, The Death Penalty, Life Stories, and Ethics, presented by Ingrid Christensen. The tape number is CHI-2002-09. Let's listen in.
My name is Ingrid Christensen, and I am teaching a session this evening on the death penalty, both some things about policy and some things about ethics regarding the death penalty. I'd like to begin by reading you a quote from Supreme Court Justice Arthur Goldberg, who once said that the deliberate institutionalized taking of human life by the state is the greatest degradation of the human personality imaginable. So now you know where I stand. You do not have here a neutral person on the subject of the death penalty, but I am open to discussion about it. I've been working in the area of the death penalty for 2 years now. My job is what they call a mitigation specialist, which is a fairly new career in the United States. All capital crimes or crimes where the state is asking for the death penalty have three parts. The first part is the pre-trial motions. The second part is the trial itself. And then if there's a finding of guilty, the third part is the sentencing part of the trial. And at least in Illinois and increasingly in some other states, there's some money available to pay people to work for the defense on the sentencing part of the trial, developing what we call the mitigating circumstances. The state, the prosecution, puts on aggravation. Basically, they show photographs of the crime scene. And the defense puts on mitigation. I, myself, use three kinds of mitigation for my clients in my work. One kind of mitigation that I look for, I spend long hours interviewing the client every other week for months in his jail cell. During those interviews, I ask him the story of his life. I ask him to tell me who raised him from year to year to year, because often it's a different person from year to year to year. I want to know exactly which schools he went to. I want to know whether he went to a church, and if so, what churches he's gone to. I want to know who his friends were. And out of that, I then go and talk to as many of those people as I can reach in the community. So I go and sit in the kitchen of his mother, if he has a mother. I sit in the homes of anybody I can find that knew him when he was coming up. And some of my clients are 50 years old, so there are a lot of people. Some of them are 20 years old or 18, so there are fewer people. What I'm looking for in these visits, and I also try to acquire all of their records, so I try to get their school records all the way through, and of course there's a law that says schools can throw away records after five or 7 years, so it's tough. But I try to get their school records, their medical records, for everything that ever happened to them, because things like who brought them to the emergency room is always an interesting question. And I try to get their incarceration records, because often they've been incarcerated as children. What I'm looking for, as I keep trying to get to, is I try to find, first of all, things about what a nice person this person is. I think you all understand that none of us is the worst thing we've ever done. That we've done terrible things and we've also done wonderful things. And so far that's been true of all of my clients. I haven't found one that was not true of. So I try to get people who can tell stories about the nice things that this person has done in his life. My clients so far have all been men. I have friends in this profession who've had women clients, so there are both men and women who are in this position. The second kind of thing I look for is I look for terrible things that have happened to them. So I try to find out the bad things about their life. If they were the victim of abuse, if they had not a stable home to live in, if they had, what unhappy or bad things have happened to them. And the third kind of thing I look for in my work is anything that a doctor can diagnose. So I want to know if he has brain damage of some kind. I want to know if he has psychological problems or mental problems, because all of those things can help to influence the mind and hearts of the jury. So that's the kind of mitigation I develop. And then how I present it to the court is, of course, another set of strategies. So that's my profession, and I work with lawyers who are in the defense for my client. Some of my clients, I think, are innocent. Most of them are guilty. I also work toward the time of the... It takes 3 years in Illinois to get from arrest to trial. Toward the end of that time, I haven't done it yet, but I've been taking training. I intend to visit as much as possible with the families of the victims of my client, because I don't think you can do a full working through of the issue and hopefully coming to some kind of healing and reconciliation without spending time with the families of the victims. That's a different story. I'm going to just go over right away some numbers about what the death penalty is and some facts. I'll do this really fast. First of all, the methods that are used in the United States for killing people, we have five. Some states use lethal gas. Some people use shooting them. Some people hang them. Some people use electrocution. And some of us use lethal injection. And in some states, there are two options or more. So that I don't think any state, for example, only does electrocution, although I'm not positive of that. Illinois, where I work, uses lethal injection. The ages that people are candidates for the death penalty. Eight states don't specify an age. So presumably a 7-year-old would be fair game. 12 states, you have to be at least 16 years old to be a candidate for the death penalty. 4 states, you're 17. 15 states, you're 18. In the United States, presently, there are about 4,000 people on death row across the country. In 1998, we killed 99 of them. And in the year 2000, we killed 85 of them. So, you know, that's roughly the number from year to year. 34 states have the death penalty. A person from any state could receive the death penalty if they commit a federal crime, a federal offense, because the feds have, and the military, have, the federal government has over 40 crimes that they punish by death. In the military, I don't know how many they have, but they have a lot. 6 countries on the globe execute children. The 6 countries are Iran, Nigeria, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, and the United States. 4 countries account for 80% of the people put to death on the planet for the death penalty: China, Iran, the Congo, and the United States. And the largest number is from the United States. 35 countries in the last 10 years have abandoned the death penalty, decided not to use it anymore. 3 countries have added the death penalty to their lexicon of punishments. So the trend globally is away from using the death penalty. There are 2 countries on the globe that have not ratified the International Covenant of the Rights of the Child: Yemen and the United States. And that includes outlawing the death penalty for children. I'll go into this more later. 12% of the population in the United States are African American. Half of the people killed in the death penalty are African American. 1/4 of the people are other persons of color, and 1/4 of the people are white. I guess those are all of my numbers. Oh, here's one more. Between 1977 and 1997, 2,029 persons in the United States were removed from death row after having been through all trials and appeals and finding of guilty and assignment of death as having been found innocent. So if 2,029 people in 20 years have been removed from death row, you know there's a problem with it. Seems to me. So those are some numbers to think about. I chose them sort of at random. There are lots of statistics available. I have a whole stack of statistics here, 36 pages of them. If you wanted to come afterwards and look up your own particular state, for example, to find out what kind of execution you use there, or if you do, and how many people you've executed, etc., that would all be in here. And that would be available from the Bureau of Justice Statistics on the internet. So if you're interested, you can always look it up. I want to tell you about one of my clients. His name is Charles. He was arrested a week after his 18th birthday for murder. He was arrested for killing a drug dealer through the window of a car. He was standing outside the car and the dealer was sitting in the driver's seat and he shot him. Or he's accused of having shot him, and he may or may not have done it. Trial hasn't happened yet, and in this country you're innocent until you're proven guilty. Charles was raised by a mother on the west side of Chicago, by a mother who was a crack addict and a father who was an alcoholic. And the father was absent from the home, but he did come around from time to time, but he was always drunk. When I met Charles, I was hired by his attorney and I met him in jail, found a very personable young man, 18 years old, who I, among other things, I asked him on the first day, how can I find your mother and father? Because I need to interview them. And he said, my mother is in Division 4 of Cook County Jail, and my father's in Division 11 of Cook County Jail. So the family is, and then I went on to ask him about his nearest sibling, and about his nearest friend, and his nearest cousin, and they were all in jail, one place or another, in prison. So there's a lot of incarceration that goes on in that family. When Charles, I neglected to tell you that all cases that qualify for the death penalty cannot be just simple murder. They must be murder with an aggravation. Every state has a different list of aggravators. Illinois has 21 aggravating factors. One of them is you're a gang member. So if you're a gang member and you murder someone, you qualify for the death penalty. One of them is, you know, you murder an elderly person or you murder a child. One of them is you commit the murder in the process of another additional felony. What qualifies Charles for the death penalty is that when he was 11 years old, he pleaded guilty to a murder and was sent away for 5 years. He was sent to Utah. He was in Utah for 5 years. His mother was sent twice to visit him during those 5 years for a weekend. So he was out of his family and in Utah for 5 years. Now, everyone that I interviewed said, in the family and among his friends, used funny language when they talked about this 11-year-old murder of Charles. They said, he copped to a murder of someone when he was 11. He pled to a murder. Nobody said he did a murder. So I started poking around in there, person after person, including talking to his mother in Cook County Jail and his father in Cook County Jail. And finally, I started getting the truth out of them. They were all sworn to secrecy on this thing. But it's in their family. The practice is that when someone is accused of a murder who is over 12 years old, a shorty, one of the younger members of the family, has to cop to the murder because the younger people only have to serve 5 years. And the older kid, in this case a 13-year-old cousin, would have to serve 40 years. So in Illinois, we try 13-year-olds as adults and send him away for 40 years. And because his family didn't want that to happen to his cousin, they persuaded Charles to cop to this crime and only go away for 5 years. So that murder that happened when Charles was 11 is what qualifies him now for the death penalty. Because it complicates, it's an exacerbating factor on the murder he's accused of having committed when he's 18. He actually went to Utah and lived in a facility there, and I've talked to many of the staff there, and I've read all of his records from his years there. And the records are heartbreakingly sweet. Utah had 5 levels that you could rise up through as you came in. You know, he came in as a sad and angry and brokenhearted 11-year-old. He, as a 1. And during his 5 years, he developed leadership skills. He became who they diagnosed when he first got there as being retarded. By the time he finished 5 years later, he was getting straight A's. He was a smart, able, leading student. He was at a 5. He had built the level of trust in Utah to the point that he was able to go and be a detail man at the local Chevrolet dealership in the afternoon after school because they trusted him and he was competent. And the owner of the Chevrolet store really respects him and likes him. So I saw this sense of stability and order that ironically came to him because of the fact that he was incarcerated somewhere where they had enough resources to take care of him and give him order and teach him to read and skills. And then the last 3 months there, the notes are they're really focused on bringing him back successfully into the community in Chicago. So they're communicating with his mother, who's, as I told you, a crack addict, although she hasn't confessed to that, to them. They're talking to his parole officer, they're talking to his godmother, who is a wonderful woman who is really committed to trying to make his life work out. But then right at the last minute, she moved to Minneapolis. So he gets back. So there's all these hopeful things about his coming back. They know what he's going to move to a suburb, and his mother's going to move to the suburb, and they have a apartment there, and she's going to leave behind her drunken boyfriend. And you know, there are all these promises that are made. And the hope is that he's got 2 credits to go. He's going to graduate from high school. He's really on a path. He flies from Utah to O'Hare Airport, and he gets off the plane, and no one is there. No one is there to meet him. He hasn't ever taken public transportation anywhere outside of his neighborhood. He has no idea how to get back to his neighborhood. He has no idea where to go in his neighborhood because where everyone lived 5 years ago has changed. His mother was high, his father was high, they forgot it was that day. It just broke my heart when I read that. When I heard that from him. And so he sort of by hook or by crook got back to his neighborhood, looked around for a bed to sleep in somebody's corner, a couch or floor or something, and started dealing drugs because that was the only thing he could do to have enough money to live. That's the only thing he knew he could do. Of course he could have called. You think, well, why didn't he call his parole officer? Why didn't he call the cops? Why didn't he call somebody? Well, he was a 16-year-old kid. He hadn't been in Chicago since he was 11. His feelings were terribly hurt. He felt so hurt and abandoned. And he said, all right, and he sort of sucked it up and said, I'll make the best of this. And he went and got himself a girlfriend whom he got pregnant and he dealt drugs. So that's Charles, who's, we sit now in jail and he talks about how to parent his child and he focuses on, he writes letters all the time to his child and he's trying to be a good person. He's really trying in every way he can. He's organized his deck in jail to commonly clean because it was a pit. And so they've cleaned all the cells. They run this cleaning organization on the deck so that they live in a pristine place. He's a cooperative. He doesn't get tickets in jail. He doesn't get in trouble. He's trying to make it work. But he's most likely going to get the death penalty. So that's one client. In Illinois, since we reinstated as a country, we reinstated the death penalty in the late 70s, I think in 1977. In Illinois, we have executed 12 people. So that's a pretty modest number. But we have released from prison as being completely innocent in Illinois, 13 people. So 13 people had gone through the entire process of arrest and trial and post-conviction attempts at relief and finally sent to death row, and then through DNA or through a confession by somebody else or something, 13 of these people have been found to be completely innocent. I think of that as being Illinois being in the business. We have 400 people on death row now. We're in the business of making parachutes. And about half of them work. You know, that ought to be good enough, right? Imagine knowing that you're jumping out of the airplane in an Illinois parachute. You know, you think, well, I got a 50-50 chance here that my parachute's going to open. It's just terrifying to think of how often we're wrong. So because of that, the state of Illinois has set aside money for people like me to try to work harder on the sentencing part of trial so we don't at least put as many people on death row. Believe me, we still incarcerate a lot of people who are innocent of their crimes. I have one client named Leroy who is innocent of this crime, and he's been on death row since 1984. He was accused of the crime in 1984 of killing 4 people, including a 9-year-old. They were all friends of his. He was accused by his stepbrother, his half-brother, who is mentally retarded. His IQ is under 70. And Leroy was his big brother, and they went everywhere together, and Leroy was a protector of the big brother. So the little brother, who did actually do the crime, said, well, he was with me. And the little brother only said that for about a day because he wanted Leroy to be with him because he felt secure and needed his big brother. And then he saw how serious it was, and he said, I lied. Leroy wasn't with me. But Leroy, when he said Leroy was with him, Leroy was locked up in Area 3, which is a police district in Chicago that is well known for using torture to get confessions from people. And there was a well-known policeman in Chicago called John, J-O-N, Burge, B-U-R-G-E, who's been in the news for years because he ran this little torture unit and tortured lots of people into giving confessions to crimes they hadn't committed. When this happened to Leroy, the torture consisted of electric prods up his rectum and a typewriter bag over his head, closing off his oxygen until he passed out on the floor, a whole series of things like that. The defense lawyers started realizing that they were hearing the same stories of torture from person after person, the same kinds of torture, and they thought, they can't all be making this up. But when it happened to Leroy, it was early in John Burge's career, and nobody knew it was a pattern. So Leroy was accused, tried, convicted, and sentenced to death. Leroy appealed his sentence on the grounds that he had confessed to the crime because he was tortured for 2 days. And the judge ruled against his appeal because the judge thought he was just whining or something. And so it's only now, he was locked up in 1984 for this crime and has been on death row all that time. Then finally, about a year ago, a judge granted him a new sentencing hearing. Not a new trial, but a new sentencing hearing. And that's when I came into the picture. Because it was so, made everyone so uncomfortable to put these John Burge victims to death. Because it was so likely that they hadn't committed the crime that they were accused of having committed.
How old was he?
Yeah. When he was, Leroy was in youth incarceration through all of his youth. Every time they would let him out of the youth prison, he would do something like walk up in front of a policeman and throw a rock through a window, and then he would be arrested again. And so there was this pattern that was even noted in his youth records that this kid wants to be in prison, because his mother was so violent that he has a big scar over one eye because she threw a knife at him once when he was 7, and she never took him to the doctor for it. And you know, she was a total addict and schizophrenic. She's now being treated. She's 75 and she's in a hospital and she's being treated, and all of a sudden she's fine. But she wasn't fine during all those years. So he was locked up all the time until he was 17. Then he was released. They had doctored his records when he was 13 to make him appear to be 14 so they could incarcerate him in a facility for older children. I kept trying to figure out why is the age wrong here? But I realized what had happened. And then when he was 17 and they released him, he stayed completely clean. He didn't do a single thing wrong. He got a job, he got married, he had children, he supported his family, he was a sort of regular community member until he was 33, and this happened. So it happened when he was 33, and he was just this hardworking father of kids and husband, and you know, he was a stand-up guy. So happy to have his own family because his family of origin had been such a nightmare. And so he was so thrilled to have Mildred, you know, his wife, who was this good, solid, stable, steady person, and to have these children. And then when he was 33, he was locked up and Mildred divorced him, and of course nobody wanted to talk to him. And his children actually do still come and visit him and write to him, and he writes to them, and they still have a friendship. So he was 33 when he was locked up, and he's 51 now. Menard.
He's still locked up.
And then just about a month ago in Illinois, we decided to have a special prosecutor to prosecute John Birch, or to investigate John Birch. So now the cop that was the torturer, there are 12 guys on death row who are all John Birch victims, and there are 68 other guys in life imprisonment who are John Birch victims. So now there's suddenly a special prosecutor who's looking into John Birch, and possibly the outcome will be that these people will get new trials.
The guy that you're talking about, even after the retarded half-brother confessed, he still has to be incarcerated, Leroy?
Once you're accused of a crime in Illinois, it's really hard to get it turned around. Oh. He's been incarcerated ever since then.
Well, one reason why that doesn't surprise me so much is that he was still incarcerated is because, have you heard of Mumia Abu-Jamal?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's one of my pen pals. He's been on death row for like 23 years.
Yeah.
And like him, because he was a Black Panther and because he wrote the truth about death row and stuff in prisons, the government wants to kill him, wants him to be killed, so they're trying everything they can to kill him.
Mm-hmm.
And so.
That's right. He's a really good example of that.
So, like, I know it's like a lot of, like,
he has a big support network.
Yeah.
He's the one guy in death row that has a big support network.
But
all of these guys that are there have compelling stories.
Yeah.
I want to say about the sort of ethical framework for this that inequity being unfairness, equals iniquity, meaning sin. That the sinfulness, the kind of wicked, corrosive effect on society that the death penalty has, comes directly it comes out of a lot of things, but one of the things it comes out of is the unfairness of it. And it's never going to be fair, so it can't be fixed. On the issue of race, let me read you a list of things that they've done a study on, every single one of these things. Here it starts. From arrest to sentencing, the criminal justice system treats people differently based on their race. A person of color is more likely than a white person to be stopped by the police. So in Chicago, we call it driving while black. You know, so the crime that you committed is driving while black. I have a colleague that I work with a lot who's a nationally syndicated reporter, who's a college professor, and a good friend of mine, Salim Muwakkil. You may have read some of his stuff. And he's constantly late to meetings because he drives a nice car, because he's a successful person, and earns a lot of money. But the cops always stop him for driving while black. They just can't believe that a black man could be driving such a nice car and not have stolen it. So you're more likely than a white person to be stopped by the police, to be abused by the police during that stop. That's a separate study. How often are people abused by the police during all their stops? If you're a person of color, it happens more often. To be arrested, so more white people are not arrested after a stop than people of color. You're more likely to be denied bail. That was a study that somebody did on judges' reactions to requests for bail. You're more likely to be charged with a serious crime, statistically. You're more likely to be convicted of a serious crime, statistically, and to receive a harsher sentence. You're certainly much more likely to get the death sentence. So the racism that's just shot through the system, it starts at the beginning and works all the way through. Then, also on the issue of race, most recently, the U.S. Department of Justice examined its own record on the use of the death penalty and found that over three-fourths of the people given the death penalty were members of racial minorities. Over half of them were African American. Although African Americans constitute only 12% of the national population, they are victims of half the murders that are committed in this country. So African Americans are more likely to be, much more likely to be a victim of murder themselves. Yet 80% of those on death row are there for crimes against white people. So although more crimes are committed, the ratio of crime against a black person is much higher than against a white. 80% of the people on death row that make it to death row are there for having killed a white person. So the punishment for killing someone white is much higher than the punishment for killing someone black. So that's just one set of things about the racial inequities. And you can see why I think it's a sin. I mean, I just think it's a sin to be such a discriminatory set of procedures. Place is unfair. In the boroughs of New York, certain boroughs, if you are accused of a crime and the state asks for the death penalty, you're much more likely to get it than in other boroughs. Some boroughs of New York, nobody gets it. The same is true in Chicago. Certain courts, you're likely to get the death penalty, other ones you're not. So if place matters that much, and it plays out so consistently that the place matters, it can't be fair. I mean, what if you happen to get arrested in one place rather than another? It's just, on the face of it, it's unfair. Poverty, of course, makes a huge difference in who gets the death penalty. Our court system, our criminal justice system, is supposed to be our insurance against discrimination based on poverty. So you're supposed to, in the grand-sounding constituting documents of our country, a poor person is supposed to receive equal justice. However, we all know that's not true. So there are people, it's legal to have a lawyer who is not sane. There are people put to death now whose lawyers were officially insane, who are not sober. So, you know, a lawyer can come drunk to the courtroom, obviously drunk, day after day. It can be reported in the newspapers. But still, there are people who have been put to death in the U.S. recently for whom it is the case that their lawyers were not sober. In fact, there's one who came out of prison lockup at the same time as his client because he was put in for drunkenness. And he was supposed to defend his client, and he lost the case. There's been a lawyer recently who was certified with Alzheimer's, whose client was put to death. There's a set of stories, many lawyers, there are a couple of them in Chicago, who routinely sleep through trials, just sound asleep, snoring away. And it's not illegal. It does not qualify you for a new trial. It doesn't get the lawyer thrown out. It's okay to have your lawyer fast asleep while you're being tried for a case where you get the death penalty. I'm going to read you a few pages of a transcript of somebody who was poor, who was on appeal, who had no lawyer at all. None. And he was given the death penalty. During the critical post-conviction review of capital cases, those condemned to die are not even entitled to a sleeping lawyer. Xavius Gibson, whose IQ was found on different tests to be between 76 and 82, stood totally bewildered in front of a judge at his first state post-conviction hearing in Georgia without a lawyer. The case proceeded as follows. The court says, "Okay, Mr. Gibson, are you ready to proceed?" Mr. Gibson, "I don't have an attorney." The court, "I understand that." Mr. Gibson, "I am not waiving my rights." The court, "I understand that. Do you have any evidence to put up?" Mr. Gibson, "I don't know what to plead." The court, "Huh?" Mr. Gibson, "I don't know what to plead." The state of Georgia, which sought to bring about Gibson's execution, was represented by a lawyer who specializes in capital habeas corpus cases. After the state's lawyer presented testimony, you know, very competent man who does these cases all the time, the judge turned again to Mr. Gibson. The court, "Mr. Gibson, would you like to ask Mr. Mullis any questions?" Mr. Gibson, "I don't have any counsel." The court, "I understand that, but I am asking, can you tell me yes or no, whether you want to ask him any questions or not?" Mr. Gibson, "I'm not my own counsel." The court, "I'm sorry, sir, I didn't understand you." Mr. Gibson, "I'm not my own counsel." The court, "I understand, but do you want to ask him anything?" Mr. Gibson, "I don't know." The court, "Okay, sir. Okay, thank you. Mr. Mullis, you can go down." That's poverty. Then let me tell you who's not spared because of their condition. Mr. Gibson wouldn't qualify. The law has recently just been changed federally so that we can no longer put mentally retarded people to death. We have not changed the law that says it's fine for schools to destroy the records. So proving that someone is mentally retarded, you can obviously give a test of somebody now, but the opposition, the prosecuting attorney, will say the guy was faking being dumb.
Are there scales for mental retardation as there are in schools?
Nobody agrees on them. So it could be 70 or 75 or 65.
Because there's the mild and there's the severe, according
right.
to...
The Supreme Court has just said you can't put retarded people to death, and they haven't said more than that, so it'll be litigated out. I have a client who was mentally retarded, who was not mentally retarded when he was a child, but because he's abused ecstasy and PCB to such an extent, it's like someone took an ice cream scoop in his brain and he's just missing whole portions of it, so he's retarded now. So whether somebody, he would be called a volunteer, mentally, or voluntarily mentally retarded person. I don't know whether he'll qualify. But anyhow, let me read you a list of people who have been condemned to death, who are, and who have not been spared, in spite of having these conditions. People who are mentally ill, lots of them. I mean, is it an illness or isn't it an illness, is a question, I suppose. You know, is it, I mean, if cancer is an illness, is mental illness an illness? Should a mentally ill person be put to death? Someone who's retarded, well, now that law has been changed, so I can strike that out of my notes. Children, as I said. People who are delusional. People who are paranoid. People who are brain damaged. People who are chemically imbalanced. People who are abused. People who are neglected. People who have post-traumatic stress syndrome from the Vietnam War. People who are drug addicted, people with various mental and emotional problems. So all sorts of mitigation that should be present there doesn't work by law. It may work to affect the jury's heart. You know, that's where a good storyteller comes in, that's where people who can do mitigation come in. But by law, none of those things exempt you from death. So now I want to read to you out of Luke a few verses to kind of add it into the mix. Even sinners lend to sinners to receive as much again. But love your enemies, Do good and lend, expecting nothing in return. Your reward will be great, and you will be the children of the Most High, for he is kind to the ungrateful and the wicked. Be merciful, just as your Father is merciful. Do not judge, and you will not be judged. What does that mean? Do not condemn, you will not be condemned. Forgive, and you will be forgiven. Give, and it will be given unto you. You know, what do we think as Christians? What do we mean when we say those words? Those are familiar words. We've heard them again and again. How do they play in our heart?
What I want to know is how come so many people who call themselves like really good Christians like say the death penalty is okay? Like my aunt, she's a Christian and really strong in her faith, but she and her family thinks the whole death penalty is okay. Like it's right. So mm-hmm. I have a question to say that that's okay.
Well, here is a copy of the social statement on the death penalty written by the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America for anybody who would like to look at it. Choice, would you mind passing around?
Sure.
That is a useful document. It was written during the time that I was the board chair of the Division for Church and Society, and so I was part of the process of producing this document. There are a few things in the Lutheran Church's position on death penalty that I think are helpful to point out. The document is nice because it lays out the arguments in favor of the death penalty as well as the arguments against the death penalty. But then the document itself comes down on the side of no death penalty. So the Lutheran Church says that in its understanding of itself, in its theological understanding of itself, it does not believe in the death penalty. But it says, I think, a wonderful thing, which is that we as Lutherans, can we get this settled somewhere? We as Lutherans have very few things that we need to believe, that we don't have as a matter of our faith to agree on lots of stuff. We don't have to agree on death penalty. We don't have to agree on human sexuality. We don't have to agree on all sorts of things that we can reflect on out of our faith, but that we don't have to have a rigid position on. So it says members of the ELCA have different points of view with regard to social issues. While the Spirit makes us one in our faith in the gospel, we can and do vary in our responses to the gospel, which I think is very helpful beyond the death penalty and thinking about other kinds of issues such as human sexuality. A couple of other things I wanted to point out. It says, people often respond to violent crime as though it were exclusively a matter of individual failure, of the criminal's individual failure. The death penalty exacts and symbolizes the ultimate personal retribution. And I would like to say that crime is socially produced. Where there's poverty, there's crime. Where there is a sick attitude about a certain group of people, an attitude toward women, there's a lot of rape, for example. Where there's racism, people of the victim races are victims of crimes. Social production of crime is pretty easy to document. So when we say that violent crime is exclusively a matter of the criminal's individual failure, we're ignoring the social production of violent crime. We're ignoring all the factors that go in. Like in my work, I tell the story of the human being that leads up to the point at which that person committed that violent crime. And there's always a story. I mean, it's never the case that there's no story. It's just sort of, you know, remember those guys 50 years ago who killed that child? The famous pair of boys?
How long ago was it?
About 50 years ago, a long time. One of the reasons that that was such a compelling story in the paper is that there was no explanation for it. These were perfectly nice boys, supposedly high school boys. But in every other case I know of, there's a story that leads up to violent crime. And so it seems to me that it's a sort of a sickness in our society that we can say it's your fault that you've committed this crime individually, as though your poverty or things like that, you're having been a victim of child sexual abuse or something, it has no part in it.
Excuse me. Will you say that the Menendez brothers, Cal and Lyle Menendez, killed their parents because of some kind of social?
I don't know that case.
Oh, you don't know?
So I would say that there's some kind of thing there, but I don't know what it is.
Okay.
Another thing about it that the document says is that killing people who kill people is perpetuating a cycle of violence. And I think, you know, I don't believe in killing people at all. Killing people who kill people or killing other people. I don't think you should kill. I think it's God's business to take people home, not ours. It says the ongoing controversy surrounding the death penalty shows the weaknesses of its justifications. We would be a better society by joining the many nations that have already abolished capital punishment. You know, the fact that there's so much controversy about the death penalty is one of the reasons that the Lutheran Church thinks this is probably a bad idea. It can't be made fair, the document says, and then it goes on and talks about the race issues and stuff like that. So, yeah.
Why can't it be another alternative?
Yeah, it can be, of course. I mean, it can be locking someone up for life, so they can't go on doing harm.
Isn't putting somebody under the death penalty more expensive than keeping them in jail?
It's actually much more expensive to keep someone under death penalty. It's much more expensive. It's about twice as much, even if they live to be like 80 years old, locked up in a secure institution. It's more expensive to put them to death because all the cost of all the appeals and all the people like me and all the expenses around the death machinery is so expensive that it is actually statistically much more expensive to give someone the death penalty, even if you kill them in 3 or 4 years, than it is to incarcerate them for life. It's also more expensive to incarcerate someone than it is to send them to Harvard. So every year, incarceration costs between $25,000 and $45,000 per person per year. So Harvard is about $40,000. So it isn't, in every case, it would be not cheaper to send them to Harvard, but the point is taken. And I mean, there are cheaper schools too, you know, we could send them to a cheaper school.
I'm curious, that's a $20,000 range that you gave.
The number of personnel and the degree of programs that are included. It's mostly personnel and tightness of security, so the expense of running an institution that's very secure has more personnel. But then, in Illinois, we're cutting out all of our schooling programs and things like that because they're expensive too. They're not very expensive.
Ingrid, what I heard you say, I just want to make sure I'm following you here, is that, and you spoke about the clients, the people that you represent, that you're not saying that they're not guilty. Mm-hmm. You're just saying that this does not warrant the death penalty.
Right. The death penalty also doesn't do any good. It doesn't. Everyone says, well, if we have the death penalty, it'll stop other people from doing crimes like this. But they've studied that, and it's not true. It doesn't stop other people. Okay. So that's just not true.
Okay.
What are some other arguments for the death penalty?
Some other what?
Arguments.
For it?
Yeah.
That it'll make the victim's family feel better. And there's a lot of work that's been done in that. In Oklahoma City, when the Oklahoma City Federal Building was bombed, at the beginning of the surveying people who are families, victims in that, there were, 400 victims or something, some enormous mm-hmm. number? A lot of people there. Something like 80 or 85% of them wanted the death penalty for the perpetrators of that crime. By the time Timothy McVeigh was put to death, half of the people wanted the death penalty for him, and the tide was turning rapidly, so that more and more of those people realized that putting him to death was not going to make them feel better.
So it was more of an emotional response at first.
Yeah, and it's often the first year after the crime that people feel that they need to have the death penalty. And then as the second year goes, they increasingly think that their loved one's death should not result in more death, that it's just not helpful.
I've been studying the death penalty for the last 7 years, and I've noticed that basically the government is saying that killing someone's not okay yet. Reason people argue against the death penalty is because basically the government is saying that killing someone's not okay, but then they turn around and kill that person. Mm-hmm. So that's one reason for arguing it.
Mm-hmm. That's premeditated murder. If you kill somebody in premeditated murder, then you get the death penalty or whatever, right? And then the person who gives out the death penalty, that's premeditated murder as well. So then don't they get the death penalty, and it just keeps going until there's no one left. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't really work very well.
Mm-hmm. Justice Blackmun, when he finished his time on the Supreme Court, when he retired, he said, "We should no longer tinker with the machinery of death. The death penalty experiment has failed." I thought it was an interesting. I want to tell one little story. So can I tell my story? Because we're going to end pretty soon. And then we might have time for a question or two. My last story, which I just love. It's a sermon. I was at a conference of people who do mitigation and who do defense of people in capital cases. So everybody, 2,000 people in the room, everybody working professionally in this field of defending people on death row. There's a man who's sort of a hero in the movement, whose name is Stephen Bright. And Stephen runs the Southern, I'll get it right here. The director for the Southern Center for Human Rights in Atlanta, and a senior lecturer at Emory Law School, and a visiting lecturer at Yale and Harvard Law Schools. He was receiving an honor from the 2,000 people in the group, and so for having been fighting the death penalty for 30 years and through his Southern Law Center. And he was then going to give a speech to us. He started his speech by saying, this was all secular people, nothing religious about this gathering. He started his speech by saying, there were three stonemasons that God saw. And God came to the first stonemason and said, who was chipping away, they were all three stonemasons chipping away at big blocks of stone. And God asked the first one, what are you doing? And the stonemason said, I'm carving this stone so it will fit perfectly into its niche in a wall. And God said, and that is good. And he went to the second stonemason and said, what are you doing? And the stonemason said, I'm earning an honest living for my family. And God said, and that is good. And he went to the third stonemason and he said, what are you doing? And the stonemason said, I'm building a fine cathedral. And then Stephen Bright went on to say, I will accept this award in the name of three of my clients. And he told about the first client. He said that he was 12 hours away from execution when finally he was exonerated from the crime, found to be innocent. And he said he went to visit him in Appalachia, drove into his farmyard, and saw him walk out of the house. And it was the first time he'd seen him walk without leg irons. And he said it was such a moment for him to see this man who'd been on death row for 12 years, was 12 hours away from being killed, and was found to be innocent of the crime and released. And the second man he told us about was a man who was what they call in the trade a volunteer, which is someone who was so tired of fighting the death penalty that he said, I want to die. Rather than living out my life on death row, I want you to give up the fight and let them put me to death. And he had persuaded that man to find meaning in his life in prison through doing service. So the man had figured out service projects in the jail that he could do that were giving him dignity and giving his life meaning. And so he was no longer a volunteer, and his sentence had been changed from death to life. And he was living out his years in a facility, but in with some dignity and with service, giving of himself. And the third man who he accepted this prize in the name of had been put to death and was dead. And he said the man was innocent. He told his story, and he told the story. May or may not have been innocent. No one knows. But he was mentally retarded, and he was, a man whose IQ was 60 or something, and had been put to death. And he said, "I'm accepting this honor in all of their names." And then he went on to say, "All of you people are toiling in a field that's very thankless. You lawyers among us are in the most despised and mistrusted population in the United States. You represent the people in the United States that we label as being the worst, the lowest of the low. You represent the murderers. So not only is your profession bad, but you are the worst end of the profession. And you lose most of your cases. And when you lose your case, your client is put to death. And yet, you come back to work the next morning, and you take another client, and you go back to work for him, and you fight for him with all your heart. And you come up with ingenious solutions, and you're chipping away at the death penalty in this land. So all of you," he said, "I want to thank you for going back to the office in the morning. I want to thank you for doing this hard, hard work. I want to thank you for enduring the death of so many of your clients, for being present at the death, for walking into that room, holding your client's eyes while they're put to death." And then he said, "Someday, that fine cathedral is going to be built, and we're going to get rid of the death penalty in this land, and it will no longer be the case that you will have to do that work. And in this fine cathedral, over the door will be a stone, and on the stone it will be written, 'Thou shalt not kill.'" I love that, Stephen Bright. He is such a good preacher, and he always preaches to everybody. I mean, he doesn't care. I mean, he's a Christian, and he just comes right out there with it. So we have a few minutes. We maybe could take 5 minutes for questions, and then we go to Vespers. So if there was a question or two, we could do it. Anybody? Yeah.
Do most of your clients tell you if they're innocent, not innocent? Like, are they truthful about it, or what is the problem with that?
It's sort of known often, but I don't ask that question because it's not my business.
I couldn't hear his question.
He wanted to know if most of my clients tell me if they're innocent or not.
Oh, okay.
And I have to say that I try not to bring the conversation to that question because that's really the lawyer's territory. My question is the mitigation, which is much more storytelling. And I mean, there are a few people like Leroy that I told you about earlier, has been featured on Bill Curtis's A&E Arts and Entertainment program as the National Miscarriage of Justice. And, he's had a lot of publicity because he's fairly well known as being someone like that. So there are a few people that I know are innocent. I assume most of my clients are guilty, which is, I don't think we should kill killers. So that's that.
Do most of the people who end up on death row have like a history of abuse or anything of that sort?
Yes, almost all of them. Almost all of them.
The majority have it?
I don't have a single client that has not been abused as a child. I have one client who, I have five clients currently. One of them was sexually abused by his pastor when he was 5 and 6. He was a happy little boy who started to mess his pants and wet the bed and stuff all of a sudden, and no one paid any attention. And that went on for a year until finally he got a really high infection, and then his auntie who he lived with took him to the hospital, and they found that he had chlamydia and gonorrhea in the mouth and in the rectum. Mm-hmm. And that was the first the family knew that this had been going on for over a year. He'd been screaming and crying and begging not to have to go off with this man. So that was one case of abuse. And then, of course, Leroy getting knives thrown at him and I mean, all of them have been abused. One of them, a white man who's 50 years old, has been an alcoholic all of his adult life, was not abused. He was in a mother who was a waitress, and he and his sister and the mother moved every 3 months because she never could pay the rent. And so she worked very hard. She was sick a lot, she had diabetes. He gave her, from the time he was six, he gave her her insulin shots in the morning. But they were just so poor. So he wasn't actually abused.
What is it going to take to get rid of the death penalty in the United States?
Prayer?
What has to happen,
right,
for us to say we no longer...
Everybody, of course, has to lobby their... It's a states' rights issue, so every...
We can't do it federally. It has to be...
Well, I don't know legally, because we've just federally said that we can't kill retarded people. Mm-hmm.
That's why I was asking the question, is that
there is a federal death penalty, and then there are 36 states or whatever.
So if the Supreme Court could actually rule it all death...
I think they probably could.
Then
I imagine the states would
get it done in one swoop.
So then you'd lobby your... Well, the Supreme Court is supposed to be beyond lobbying. Mm-hmm.
Well, federally, we had a moratorium on it for quite some period of time, didn't we?
Yeah, we did.
So, you know, in a sense, it was...
During the 70s. Yeah. It's a really interesting line of how many people have been put to death. I have a picture of it in here where, you know, there'll be hundreds, and then the numbers go down to two digits, and then the numbers go down to one digit, and then there's a string of zeros. And then it goes to one digit, and then two digits, and then three digits again on one page. It sort of, there was about 10 years when it was a string of zeros, from about 67 to 77.
Well, there was a time when the Supreme Court ruled against the death penalty, and they didn't allow it in this country.
That was that period of time. And then after that, it was brought back by the states one by one, so I'm just not sure whether it could be gotten rid of federally. Patsy. Okay, Denise.
I wanted to ask you, do it be the families trying to pursue the death penalty, or do it be the criminal justice system? Do the families want the...
The person that has the right to choose in every case whether we will ask for death or not is the prosecutor, the prosecuting attorney. So every prosecuting attorney can decide this is going to be a death case or it's not. And the prosecuting attorney, of course, wants to talk the victim's family into wanting the death penalty. So they get mad when people like me come and ask them.
Why do they want to talk?
Why do they want the death penalty?
Yeah.
Prosecuting district or state's attorneys tend to be people who run for political office, and public defenders tend not to be. And so it's a notch in their gun or whatever. It's in some sense that they're a successful attorney if they get lots of convictions and death penalties, and it makes them a good candidate for political office.
That's horrific. That's really, really disgusting.
It might be a little too cynical on my part.
Being perceived as being hard on crime is a political plus, unfortunately, still in this country.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We're part of the war on crime.
I was just wondering, when you say that people are abused and therefore, all of your clients have been abused at one point or another, what do you say when someone asks you if that excuses them from being charged with murder given the death penalty? Because I think that, I know that it is thought that if you are abused, it's sort of this horrible thing happened to you, and it makes you more susceptible to commit a crime of your own. But how does that change what they are when they're adults? I don't quite understand.
I think I understand your question. I think it's a really good question. There's a saying among public defenders, we know who the victim is here. And by knowing who the victim is here, we know that it's the dead person. Mm-hmm. And so using abuse as a defense is not defensible. Mm-hmm. But using abuse as mitigation, in other words, saying, the person is a damaged human being because of the abuse and because of the damage committed a horrific crime, it doesn't mean that we should release this person out into society, but it also doesn't mean that we should put the person to death.
But how do you explain that to people who think that you should? Because it could be easily argued that if they're a damaged human being, they still committed a horrific crime.
I don't know the answer to the question. I mean, I think you have to use ingenuity for the best you can.
Thank you.
Thank you.